I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The 72-hour truce between Gaza and Israel is holding after a month of fighting as mediators in Egypt get ready to negotiate a more durable peace, no easy task. Israel wants a demilitarized Gaza and the end of rocket attacks, while Hamas wants the end of the blockade, the release of prisoners, and more international aid to rebuild its economy. This is the third conflict between Gaza and Israel in the last 5 to 6 years, and the most devastating with nearly 2,000 dead, most of them Palestinians and many of them civilians. Today on Radio Times, many questions. Will the truce hold? Is a negotiated settlement possible? And what about the two-state solution? Joining us is Daniel Kurtzer, professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. For 29 years, during his career with the U.S. Foreign Service, he served as U.S. Ambassador to Egypt and U.S. Ambassador to Israel, wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace. And Ambassador Kurtzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Khaled El-Gindi. He's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served most recently as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009. He was also a key participant in the round of negotiations at Annapolis in November 2007. Khaled El-Gindi, you made it. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
Glad to be here.
I'll let you catch your breath. Let me go to you, Daniel Kurtzer. Does something significant need to happen in the next, 24 to 30 hours before the end of this 72-hour truce?
Well, both sides are experiencing conflict fatigue, so it's quite possible that even if a larger ceasefire agreement is not reached, that they will not return to active military engagement. But without a serious agreement, we're looking at short-term solutions. As you noted in the top of the report, there have been three outbreaks of violence in the last 6 years, actually four outbreaks in the last 8 years. And, it could happen again. It's like the Rocky movie. They knock each other around for a while, and then they get up and they have a sequel.
To you, Khaled El-Gindi, is there something you think that could continue the ceasefire?
Well, I think Dan's right. I think there is a degree of battle fatigue that's set in. I think both sides have been beaten up, although not in the same way. I think on the Palestinian side, they are clearly physically beaten up. I think on the Israeli side, politically, perhaps morally, psychologically, there's been a great deal of damage done to Israel's image, to its international standing, even here in the United States. So I think it is unlikely that we'll return to active fighting. I think if there is a resumption of hostilities, it would be more along the lines of a kind of drawn-out war of attrition rather than the kind of intense violence that we saw over the last month.
And when you talk about Israel's, I guess, reputation, are you referring to the numbers of civilians that have been killed or wounded in Gaza?
Yes, primarily, but also the scale of destruction of civilian infrastructure, 10,000 homes completely destroyed. and just to clarify, it's not many of those killed and injured are civilians. The overwhelming majority of them of Palestinians who were killed were, in fact, civilians. Something like 400 children have been killed in this conflict. That's in addition to the 10,000 or so who've been injured, 400,000 who've been displaced, and the psychological trauma to adults and children for many years to come. And I think one of the extremely short-sighted, something that points to the very short-sighted nature of Israel's approach to warfare of overwhelming disproportionate force is even setting aside the moral implications. From a security standpoint, it's impossible to see how creating such human misery in a place that is already rife with misery and poverty is going to contribute in any way to Israel's security. On the contrary, I would imagine that many of those who are traumatized, many of those who have lost family members, which is quite a large proportion of Gaza's population, will feel the need to avenge that violence and return, somehow bring it back to Israel. So it would not surprise me to see more terrorist attacks against Israelis in the future.
Daniel Kutcher, I'd be curious about how you think about this, or perhaps even wrestle with this. Israel says it does not target civilians, but clearly civilians have paid a huge price in Gaza. How do you, I guess, reconcile the fact that Israel says, you know, it's our right to defend ourselves against rocket attacks, and there have been rocket attacks, but they have such a disproportionate amount of military to use against the Palestinians?
Well, the Israelis have a particular way of looking at their relationship with Palestinians in the context of history. You heard during this conflict several times Israeli spokesmen, including the Prime Minister, refer to the carpet bombing of Dresden during World War II or other occasions, Vietnam, when civilian casualties were extraordinarily high. But there wasn't the kind of outcry that we're hearing now about Israeli actions. And so the Israelis, from their perspective, argue that there is something of a double standard in the way that others treat Israel's security problems. They claim, and I think it's true, that they don't actively target civilians. But as President Obama and Secretary Kerry have said, it may be that they don't take enough care in responding to what they believe are attacks emanating from civilian areas. We do know that Hamas has set up rockets in the courtyards of civilian neighborhoods and even hospitals. The Israelis returned fire from the origin of the rockets, and that's when the civilians are injured and killed. So, you know, from watching this from the outside, it is a very uneven battle. Israel has a preponderant force, and they now have the ability to protect their civilian population through the use of this Iron Dome technology. But if you look at it from the Israeli standpoint, they argue that once they're attacked by Hamas, and Hamas is operating from within a civilian environment, they need to respond to those attacks, and unfortunately, civilians end up suffering.
Khalid, Hamas has said that one of their missions is the destruction of Israel. How do you suggest that Israel respond to that threat, obviously, and to these attacks?
Well, you're referring to Hamas's notorious charter.
Yes.
And it's quite it is quite terrible. Many of the things that in Hamas's charter are anti-Semitic and violent and quite vile in every way. But I think we have to distinguish between words in a charter that was created a quarter century ago and where we are today. The fact is that Hamas is a political organization. Hamas has sent signals of various kinds in the lead up to the election in 2006 and even before that and since, that it is willing to live in a two-state scenario on the 1967 borders. It is willing to accept a Palestinian state with full sovereignty in the 1967 borders in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which is identical to the PLO's position and most other Palestinian factions. And I think even the clause to calling for Israel's destruction was actually dropped from Hamas's pre-election program in 2006. So I'm not in any way defending Hamas's actions or its ideology, but I think it's important to put in perspective that Hamas is a political movement. It has evolved, it continues to evolve, and it has sent signals that we are completely ignoring. And I would also point out that, you know, while there is certainly extremism on the Palestinian side, there is a tendency to overemphasize what Palestinians say. and overlook what Israelis do. What Israel is doing on the ground is not theoretically destroying a future Palestinian state. It is physically, actually, in real time, destroying a Palestinian state. So as far as who would want to destroy who, I think we really have to evaluate on the basis of not just rhetoric and ideology, but also actions. But if we want to look at ideology, just look at the various members of the Israeli cabinet who are calling for who openly oppose the two-state solution, or who there are Knesset members from the ruling party, the ruling coalition, who are calling for atrocities against Palestinians. These are unfortunate things. The Likud party platform is quite terrible as well. I think that is normal in the context of a conflict, and that is why it is important to resolve conflict. I don't think that we can establish preconditions and hoops that everyone has to jump through in order to be eligible to resolve a conflict.
Daniel Kircher, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I've met Khaled Mashal, the external political leader of Hamas, twice in the last few years. And I'm not sure that I've seen much evolution in thinking. The words very often sound moderate, because he will say, he has said it, for example, publicly on Charlie Rose, he will say that Hamas is ready to accept a Palestinian state in the territories from which Israel withdraws. But when you ask the next question, which is, well, does that mean you are willing to accept a two-state solution, and that includes the state of Israel, he's very honest, and he says no, that Hamas will not accept the existence of the state of Israel. So it may be that, you know, in a long arc of history, Hamas is inching towards change, but I wouldn't rely upon that in the short term. That said, where Khaled is exactly right is, you know, the focus shouldn't be on Hamas. The focus should really be on what I would call mainstream Palestinian politics, the politics of the PLO, which still remains, despite all these problems, the potential peace partner for the state of Israel. And this war has diverted attention from the failure of Israel and the Palestinians over the years, and the failure of the United States to move towards a two-state solution. So, Marty, you asked at the beginning of the show, you know, can this ceasefire hold?
Right.
Well, if all we end up with is a ceasefire, then everything here is a failure. What we really need to do is move towards a resumption of a process that gets us to a two-state solution.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Daniel Kircher. He served as U.S. ambassador to both Egypt and also U.S. ambassador to Israel. He's currently a professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Also with us, Khaled El-Gindi. He's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and he served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on the West Bank. And we are talking about the current ceasefire and conflict between Israel and Gaza, raising a whole host of questions. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Fleischer Art Memorial supports WHYY and offers a chance to explore your creative side this fall. With a 117-year tradition of making art accessible to all, Fleischer offers classes and workshops for artists of all skill levels from throughout the Delaware Valley. Register now for one of 70-plus workshops in painting, photography, sculpture, ceramics, printmaking, art history, and more. Fall classes begin September 8th. Registration and tuition information at fleischer.org.
I'm Eric Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit under the daily news shows. This American Life.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Most people never read those long user agreements when they sign up for everything from music streaming to email. So why don't people accept them?
If you don't click accept, you basically have to opt out of the internet.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the current ceasefire between Gaza and Israel, the potential for a more lasting peace. And again, our guests are Daniel Kurtzer and Khaled El-Gindi. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Khaled, who then should be sitting around the negotiation table?
Well, of course, I agree with Dan that we should, you know, certainly a certain degree of skepticism is warranted with regard to Hamas or any of the actors in this whole situation. But I'm very skeptical also of this notion that we can make peace with one set of Palestinians while isolating or making war on another group of Palestinians. The fact is that you make peace, one, with your enemies, two, as a whole. So the notion, this has actually been, I think, one of the great failings of U.S. policy for the last almost decade, in which we've had no policy on Gaza and Hamas, where we've treated the two separately. We deal with Gaza and Hamas as one conflict, and then we deal with the West Bank and Mahmoud Abbas as a different conflict in which there's a so-called peace process. I think that's a fantasy-based approach to diplomacy and conflict resolution. You have to, you know, all Palestinians, one of the most striking things about the current ceasefire talks is that you have all Palestinians, a joint delegation representing every Palestinian faction, participating in these talks under, at least nominally, the leadership of the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. That is how it should be. Hamas cannot be isolated from the Palestinian political landscape. It is part and parcel of it. And so they need to be at the table, if not across the table from the Israelis, at least in the context of internal Palestinian politics. And that is what is coming out of this process. I think we could have, if we had accepted, if Israel had accepted the idea of Palestinian reconciliation and a unified Palestinian polity of some sort, then we could have avoided all this bloodshed. But it's clear now that there is no going forward without a unified Palestinian political address.
Daniel Kurtzer, is it time then to deal with the leadership in Gaza and the leadership in the West Bank together as a kind of unified or unity government?
You know, Marty, I think Khaled had the diagnosis right. I would differ just a little bit on the cure. There was a moment in, I think, April, May of this year, right after the Palestinians came up with a reconciliation formula that allowed for a technocratic government to emerge. There was a moment when the U.S. administration got it right, because it basically said, we're not going to focus on Hamas anymore. We're going to focus on the Palestinian government. And as long as that government maintains its fealty to the issue of recognition of Israel, to the renunciation of terrorism, it almost doesn't matter to us who comprises that government. And that's always been the weakest point of American policy. By focusing on Hamas, we were giving them a kind of unit veto, as opposed to keeping the focus on the Palestinian Authority. So I don't think that Hamas has to be sitting opposite Israel at the table. The Palestinian government, the PLO and the Palestinian Authority, have to sit opposite Israel. But for the Palestinians to make sense of their representation, they do need reconciliation, and that's where the United States, the international community, and Israel have to be understanding of internal Palestinian politics.
But Daniel Kurtzer, do you think the Palestinian Authority has been weakened, not just by the various conflicts between Israel and Gaza, but also the growth of settlements in the West Bank and the fact that they haven't made the kind of progress that they say they want for Palestinians living in this part of the world?
Oh, for sure. I think one of the most significant criticisms that can be leveled at Israel in this context is the degree to which they have undermined the legitimacy and well-being of their peace partner through settlement activity, through even their public statements. In the middle of this confrontation between Israel and Hamas, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, took the occasion to say that Israel would never give up security control of the West Bank Well, what kind of signal is he sending? He's sending a signal that says, well, we do have a security problem with Hamas, but we're not going to fix our problem with the Palestinian Authority either.
To you, Khaled Al-Gindi, and some have described, and these tend to be people living in Gaza, but describing it as a prison for the people that live there. Do you see it that way?
Yes, I think that's actually not even, it's not hyperbole to describe Gaza as an open-air prison. It's a physical reality, and has been for most of the last 7 years. And so when we talk about Israeli security, obviously Israel has a right to defend itself, and Israeli citizens should live in security. But that security cannot come at the expense of the security of another people. And I think that's another failing of American policy, which frankly hasn't changed. American policy, you know, I heard John Kerry this morning talking about Israel has a right to defend itself, absolutely, and that, you know, all of this collateral damage. This is not collateral damage. What is not often talked about is that Israel's war doctrine is, in fact, aimed at creating massive civilian casualties and civilian destruction of civilian infrastructure. It is a doctrine of warfare, which it refers to as the Dahiya doctrine, based on what it did in Lebanon in 2006, in which the goal is to create, is to respond deliberately with overwhelming disproportionate force and targeting civilian infrastructure, targeting buildings. It's not just a disregard for civilians. Civilian suffering is actually part of the equation, and I have serious moral as well as legal qualms about this sort of an approach to warfare. So when we have to factor that into the equation. This isn't simply collateral damage.
Is it a war crime? I mean, do you see this as a war crime?
I personally think there is very strong evidence of war crimes, and I would certainly want to see, and I think the international community should support, an international credible investigation into violations of international humanitarian law by all sides, and let the chips fall where they may. But this kind of warfare is just, you know, self-defense is not a blank check to commit any and all acts. I mean, just like, you know, the rightness of a cause is not a blank check. That's the logic of terrorism, actually, where the ends justifies the means. So, yes, Israel has a right to defend itself, but it does not have the right to do anything it wants to defend itself, including completely, you know, total disregard for civilian life. In cases where you have an entire building is destroyed in order to kill one person, 35 people have to be killed. That's not an acceptable way, and it's completely contrary to the laws of war.
Do you want to respond to that, Daniel Kurtzer?
Yeah, I don't agree that this is either a violation of the laws of war or what warrants some international investigation. You know, unfortunately, we're in a period, and we have been in a period for years, in which bad things happen in violent confrontations. Middle East alone right now, you've got all kinds of deaths occurring as a result of the conscious actions of political actors, be they states or non-state actors. So to put Israel under the microscope here and to subject this particular conflict to yet another international commission, to me seems excessive. That doesn't mean that Israeli actions should not be subjected to review, and I think the Israelis go through their own internal reviews. Every war that they've had has been followed by an internal commission of inquiry, and in most cases they've learned lessons from those commissions of inquiry. But to use this war as a kind of poster child when you've got all kinds of other problems out there, I think, is excessive.
Well, and I know we could go on in this. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Daniel Kurtzer. He served as U.S. ambassador to Egypt and to Israel, currently a professor at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Also with us, Khaled Al-Gindi. He's a fellow for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution and has served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership. And we are talking about what many people are talking about, which is the fighting, the war, if I can say, between Gaza and Israel. Israel. There is a truce in effect, and there are negotiations underway. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel Kurtzer, if I can go back to you, and then I do want to get to our callers. It's interesting that, that Egypt seems to be the mediator, and you are quoted in the New York Times recently as saying this is the most sustained period of antagonism in the relationship between Israel and the United States. I don't know how the relationship recovers as long as you have this president and this prime minister. Is that a problem when it comes to negotiating some kind of a short-term settlement or even a long-term settlement?
Well, on the one hand, I think Egypt's involvement is a positive here. Egypt does not have a very good relationship with Hamas at the moment, but it is an Arab state with some convening power. And the fact that all the parties are now in Cairo, even given the Egyptian relationship with Hamas, tells you that it's a good thing that Egypt's involved. On the other hand, the tension that has persisted in the U.S.-Israeli relationship almost nonstop since both Obama and Netanyahu came to power about 5.5 years ago is definitely a drag on these negotiations. The two of them don't trust each other. They don't like each other. They have used many occasions to say things about each other that undermines the respective credibility. I frankly don't understand why the Israelis would do this, given the fact that the U.S. has been such a constant friend, and why they would seek to undercut American credibility at a time when that credibility is coming under question anyway. So it's a real problem, both in the immediate term, but also over the longer term. How do you get out of this and preserve what's good about the Israeli-U.S. relationship?
To you, Khaled, is Egypt the right broker, do you think, for this current situation?
Yeah, I think it's true. Egypt is an essential player in this whole situation. I don't see any way around an Egyptian role, for good or for ill. I mean, I think Egypt hasn't played as constructive a role or hasn't had the sense of urgency that it ought to have had, largely because it sees itself as, in some ways, Hamas as an extension of its own war against the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. So it has, I think, it has its own political and ideological agenda in this whole situation. Mm-hmm. But there's no way around an Egyptian role because Egypt is the only other direct stakeholder in Gaza. It has a border with both Israel and Gaza. And so nothing can come in or out of Gaza without Egyptian and or Israeli approval. So it is the logical address to be brokering this ceasefire.
Even though it opposes Hamas?
Even though it opposes Hamas. And I think one, maybe the only positive thing that could come out of this whole situation is the fact that you do have a unified Palestinian delegation that is negotiating and that everyone is now talking about a return of the Palestinian Authority to Gaza in one form or another. And so everybody gets the Egyptians have some cover. They're not rewarding Hamas. They're rewarding Mahmoud Abbas and his Palestinian leadership. Israel can say the same. Hamas can say it's getting a lifting of the blockade eventually, if that is part of what is currently being negotiated, which I think it has to be. So there is, a way out. It's just unfortunate that it took 2,000 lives and all kinds of destruction to achieve something that many of us had been calling for the past several years. And so it's unfortunate.
Indeed. Let me get Carl from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Carl, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. It's so good to talk to you, Marty.
Thanks.
I've been listening with some distress because what hasn't been mentioned is that Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005. And American philanthropists even gave $15 million they paid for the greenhouse equipment. Palestinians destroyed it all. That was when the PLO was supposedly in control. And also, I want to... So that has to be talked about. They gave aid. And the three wars were all caused by Hamas's missiles, also want to talk about the two-state solution.
Well, you know what, Carl? Let me take the first 2 points because they're important ones and they really are very germane to what we are talking about. I'll put this to you, Khaled Al-Gindi, which is that, yes, Israel did withdraw from Gaza, and there have been problems since then. From Carl's perspective, he's basically saying it's the Palestinians' fault in Gaza for the problems in that neighborhood, so to speak.
Right. It's true. Israel withdrew its settlers and its soldiers from Gaza in August and September of 2005. There was an agreement, a very limited agreement, to allow for the opening of Gaza's borders, called the Agreement on Movement and Access, and to connect Gaza to the West Bank. That was signed in late 2005. That agreement was never implemented in any meaningful way. It was essentially a dead letter, and by the end of 2005, it simply was dead. And in January 2006, Hamas was elected, and we are where we are today, essentially, since Hamas's rise to power is what led to an even tighter restrictions around Gaza's borders until 2007, when we had a full-on blockade by Israel. So, yes, it's true that Israel withdrew its forces, but it never relinquished control over Gaza. It controls Gaza's air, land, and sea. It controls Gaza's exports, which are almost nothing. It controls even Gaza's the population registry in Gaza is still controlled by Israel. In every legal sense, Israel is the occupying power in Gaza. You don't need a military presence on the ground to exercise effective control. And that's what Israel has done. And so it is still responsible for the Gaza Strip in a legal sense. But in a practical sense, it has also, the blockade, the control of almost everything in Gaza is what has resulted in this violence.
Well,
the tunnels and the rockets are primarily aimed at trying to lift the blockade, and that's why Palestinians overwhelmingly support, whether we like it or not, these types of actions.
And to you, Daniel, of course, we're almost up at a break here, but is it time, do you think, to lift the blockade?
Oh, definitely, and it's been time for a long time. And there are ways to deal with Israeli security requirements. Look, the Egyptians also have imposed a kind of blockade because there's been smuggling from Gaza into Sinai, creating an internal security challenge to Egypt. But these are really technical issues. You can develop an international flotilla to ensure the security at sea. You can shore up security at the crossing points. So it's definitely time to allow Gazans to breathe, but it also means that you have to have a responsible government in Gaza that's going to do its best to police Gaza and ensure law and order there.
And that's Daniel Kurtzer, who joins us along with Khaled Al-Gindi. And both of our guests have played roles on both sides of the peace negotiation process in the past, involving Israel and Palestinians. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. How does this all end? We'll be right back.
Rider University supports WHYY. Rider invites listeners to learn about how its executive MBA program can help professionals leverage their business experience into greater leadership roles in their organizations. Rider is hosting an information session in Princeton, New Jersey on August 9th. Information is available online at rider.edu/EMBA or 609-896-5036. Rider University, preparing tomorrow's business leaders.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Sabrina Tavernisi describes her experiences as one of the first reporters at the site of the downed Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, where she felt alone with the dead. She spent several weeks covering the conflict in Ukraine. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Feminists, put down your weapons and pick up your minds.
I'm honest about my contradictions and my inconsistencies and that I'm not, you know, always on the right side. But I'm willing to stand up and say, yes, I am a feminist.
Roxane Gay is a feminist, a bad feminist. More about that next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The 72-hour ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is holding, and this is the third time in the last about 5.5 years of fighting has broken out between Israel and Gaza. We are talking about the possible chances for a more lasting peace, and again with Daniel Kurtzer. He was U.S. ambassador to Israel and to Egypt. Also, Khaled El-Gindi was an advisor to Palestinian leadership in the West Bank. Let me get Sarah from Hopewell, New Jersey, to join us. Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you, Marty. Can I just say that I love your program?
Oh, thank you so much.
So I'll try to make a few points very quickly here. I'm an Egyptian citizen, but I live in the U.S. It's been a year now. And as an average person, I'm just trying to talk maybe on behalf of people who are not involved in politics. I am so tired of the spectacle of politics. Of attempts to sound diplomatic, politically correct, balanced, and at the expense of 2,000 people that were just killed. What's happening right now is politicians are using all this sophisticated talk to and distracting us from a very recent history. At the end of the day, Israel is occupying Palestine, most of Palestine, okay? So I agree with Hans' point about the fact that maybe on paper, and I don't like Hamas whatsoever, but maybe on paper Hamas might not accept Israel, but on the ground, look at what Israel is doing. Israel is trying to wipe out Palestine altogether. That's the first point.
Well, you know what, Sarah, only because we have a lot of people on the line, and I appreciate the call, and I want to pick up on the first thing you said about your frustration with the political engagement and perhaps even suspicion about whether people are really willing to address some of these important issues. And let me toss that first to you, Daniel Kurtzer.
Well, I'm sympathetic with Sarah's frustration, even though I've been part of what she would call the problem. I've been a diplomat for 30 years. But the reality is that's the way the rules of the game play out. If there's a better way of deciding how conflicts end other than through diplomacy or war, then someone ought to come up with it. Since leaving government, I've been involved in what's called Track 2 diplomacy, which is when non-government officials meet and they talk without the responsibility of counting every word or parsing every syllable. And, it's a way of conversation. But at the end of the day, you need to consummate discussions with agreements that are enforceable and for which governments take responsibility. And I don't know if there's a better way than through diplomacy.
Well, and even going back to this particular crisis, Khaled, Israel wants to demilitarize Gaza, the end of rocket attacks. Hamas wants the end of the blockade, release of prisoners, more international aid to help rebuild their economy. Are all those potentially doable from your perspective?
I think they're all doable. It's a question of the sequence and the process. The idea that demilitarization of Gaza would be a short-term objective, I think, is not realistic. Israel itself, with all its military might, is unable to physically disarm Hamas or armed groups in the Gaza Strip, which is a very tiny area. In order for it to do so, it would be an enormous cost, both in military and human terms. Disarming, I think, is a long-term objective, and it has to be linked to not just ending the blockade. I think ending the blockade is, in fact, not even a political demand at this point. It is a humanitarian imperative. There is simply no way to avert a humanitarian crisis without opening up Gaza's borders in the short term, but also to allow Gaza to have an economy to function normally. And that has to happen over the short term. Demilitarization, I think, can happen in the context of resolving the conflict and ending the occupation. Because as long as there is an occupation, and there is an occupation in both the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, then you will have the incentive to arm and rearm for Palestinians to try and fight the occupation. Israel is not going to end its occupation unilaterally. It must be forced in one way or another to end the occupation. It's not going to agree simply because everybody is quiet and calm and recognizing Israel. That has shown actually to produce the opposite. When you have a Palestinian leadership that is extremely accommodating in terms of Israeli security and political demands, then that leadership tends to be ignored. Those who get attention, unfortunately, are those who engage in violence, and that is what produces results. And so there needs to be, I think, a linking. Israel's security, long-term security, can only happen in the context of Palestinian freedom and ending the occupation.
Do you agree with that, Daniel Kircher? Then we'll get back to our callers. And Sarah, thanks for the call.
Oh, sure. I think Hal is exactly right. And as I indicated earlier, you can reach a ceasefire agreement, but without something more durable, whether it is a full-fledged two-state solution or various agreements that lead you on a pathway to that outcome, then you're fated to have these periodic outbursts of violence recur from time to time. Hal is exactly right.
Sarah wanted to talk about the two-state solution, Daniel Kircher. Should all this be sort of linked together, or is it dealing first and foremost with this conflict between Israel and Gaza?
You know, we've tried over the years to disaggregate the idea of a two-state solution or to deconstruct it and to try to build small things into a larger construct, and it doesn't work. If the two sides don't know that this is part of a process that we expect will result in a full agreement, then it's hard for them to do the small parts, and it's certainly hard for them to move forward. And so they take the easy route by not going forward. And therefore, I would use this occasion. I mean, all wars are supposed to have a political outcome. This one so far doesn't have one. I'd use this occasion to construct a political vision and a political structure in which both the ceasefire negotiations, the end of the blockade, a move towards demilitarization, it's going to be hard. In other words, you put all these things together and you conduct diplomacy to get there.
Let me get Edward from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Edward, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. I agree, and I want to bring back a point that Hal had mentioned earlier about both sides should be subjected to war crimes, because for number one, Hamas is doing a very bad thing by not picking a better base to fight from, and they're specifically picking places that are populated with civilians. And on the other side, if Israel knows this, then this doesn't just give Israel the right to send rockets because this is where Hamas is at. If they know that the civilians are there, then they have to come up with a better solution of either sending ground troops in to get Hamas or to get their targets or find another solution. You can't just send rockets.
Well, Edward, let me give Khalid Ogundi a chance to respond to your comments. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Khalid, go ahead.
Well, I agree. I mean, it just goes to this point that I was trying to make earlier, and that is you cannot achieve security for your own people at the expense of the security of another people. That's not how conflicts are resolved. And I think this is where the United States comes in, and I agree completely with Dan on the need for some sort of a vision, a pathway forward that links these various components together in a meaningful way and that involves all the relevant stakeholders, including but not only Hamas. And this is really what's been missing. You know, Dan was part of this process more than a decade ago of what most people have forgotten now, the roadmap. There was, in fact, a roadmap for Middle East peace a long time ago. It's now completely outdated. It's been overtaken by events and totally neglected. But something like that, I think is absolutely needed. You need, you know, part of the problem of this administration is they have focused exclusively on conflict resolution and completely ignored conflict management or mitigation or prevention. And that has to be part of any peace process. You know, and that is what the old roadmap did. It linked up short-term security and other objectives to a longer-term political resolution. And so what's missing now is that safety net. So when negotiations fail, you don't simply slide toward the abyss, but you actually have a basis by which to prevent both sides from harming each other. And that's what actual mediation and leadership is, and it's been completely absent from the United States for the last 6 or 7 years.
Dana Kurtzer, how do you think John Kerry has done to try to negotiate some of this? He clearly has not been successful at it, but he certainly has been trying. But has he been saying and doing the right things from your perspective?
Well, Marty, as we've discussed over the past year, I think Kerry's diplomacy, maybe starting last summer until about February or March, was actually quite enlightened, because he understood that you don't just get the parties back to the negotiating table. You have to build a kind of architecture or construct of peace. And then it went off rails, and the United States walked away by calling a pause in the process. He then tried to jump back in during this conflict, but may have created more damage than help by diverting attention from Egypt's diplomacy. You remember the Egyptians had gotten a ceasefire proposal and had brought Israel on board, which is always very hard to do. They had not yet brought Hamas on board, and then Kerry came in and kind of diverted attention to Qatar and Turkey. And it took a little while to get things back on track. And that also caused some more tension in the U.S.-Israeli relationship. So I think there is a learning curve here that I think the administration is experiencing, but it still hasn't gotten the essential point, which is you can't conduct diplomacy in this sub-region by calling a pause on the peace process and expecting to resolve this particular conflict between Israel and Hamas. It just won't work.
Let me get Megan from Kimberton to join us. Megan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'd like to go back to the other woman who spoke, that at the end of the day, Israel is obliterating and slaughtering Palestinians. It's not on paper. It's the reality. And the United States, as far as I have known, and I'm half Jewish, we support Israel. We do not support the Palestinians. And I'm not going to separate again and say Hamas versus Palestinians. We do not support the Palestinians. We never have. That is something that I have always wanted to ask, is why?
Well,
why are we supporting Israel and not Palestine at the same time?
Well, let me give Dana Kurtzer a chance to respond to that. Do you agree with her picture that she painted?
Well, in practical terms, yeah. I mean, we have a very strong and long-term bilateral relationship with Israel. It's called a strategic relationship. It involves a great deal of intelligence and counterterrorism cooperation. It involves political relations. We provide substantial assistance. We do provide some assistance to the Palestinians, but nowhere near the magnitude that we provide to Israel. So, you know, the reality is the relationships are different. We have also played the role of third party in this conflict, but now people are calling that into question. And it may be that given the nature of the relationship with Israel, it's time to what I would call multilateralize the peace process, revive the so-called quartet, which was the U.S., Europe, Russia, and the United Nations, and bring in also the Arab world, which developed an Arab peace initiative back in 2002 in order to help redress this imbalance in the relationship between the United States and Israel and the United States and the Palestinians.
Just a couple of minutes before I have to say goodbye, Khalid, let me go back to you then. What will you be, I guess, looking for in the next maybe couple of hours, days, weeks, as we keep our eye on this particular conflict?
Well, we'll want to see what comes out of these talks. And I think actually the longer they go on, the more positive a sign it is, and might actually be something along the lines of what Dan and I were talking about, a pathway forward. But that will require leadership. And I'm afraid that the United States has not shown that kind of a leadership. I think the quartet as an idea was nice 12 years ago or whenever it was, but it's now completely defunct. I do believe that the situation requires multilateral involvement, but there has to be a leader. Someone has to orchestrate and bring these groups together. And that role, I think, ought to fall to the United States, but it's not. I think there's a real absence of leadership here. I think to simply leave the parties to their own devices is a recipe for continued conflict by definition.
To you, Daniel Kurtzer, 30 seconds. Does the United States then have to have this leading role, as Khaled El-Gindi just said?
I would agree. I call it more of a convening role. I think we've demonstrated that we're just not willing to do all of the hard work ourselves. And if that's the case, we do need other parties, Europe and the Arab world, and we do have the convening power to bring all of those folks together. And there are ideas out there for doing so, but you've got to get it started, and until now, we've shirked that role.
Well, as always, we've had the two of you together several times. I always learn so much. Daniel Kurtzer, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
And he's professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Khaled El-Gindi, thank you very much as well.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. He's a fellow for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. And again, both of our guests have played key roles in past peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, email, and the weekly Radio Times newsletter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.